Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another day here at the Damage Report. It's a Tuesday. You know what that means? A guest. So who do we have for you today? Let's spin the wheel, and it's coming up. Viviana, welcome back to the show.
Hello. Great to have you here. So glad to be back. It's always a pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here, and it's especially great to have you here at a time when we can actually say what it is that we've sort of weirdly alluded to or danced around in the past. So give us the update.
Well, I think we did allude to it, and your viewers might have already seen it. I've been producing some videos. I've been joining the Young Turks on various platforms, but you'll be able to see some videos that I'm producing and hosting weekly so far, maybe more to come on Rebel HQ, Facebook. But also, you know, just make sure you're following all of the different channels from the Young Turks, including the Damage Report on Facebook, because they will repost some of the videos. We've already done one on how, you know, the Capitol insurrectionists, I believe, are gang related. They are gangs, and we should treat them as such, because gangs have really harsh punishments in this country for their, you know, behavior, and we are not obviously holding these insurrectionists to the same standard. I mean, we have people suspected of being gang involved have gang injunctions put on their sentences, you know, 3, 5, up to 7 more years sometimes, just because they have gang tattoos. So we know these oath keepers have their badges. Everybody's got their infamous MAGA hat. I think they need to be held to the same standards. So you can watch that video amongst others. Coming up, I'm going to be working on one on transphobia. I have a video coming up about how PragerU is using fear-mongering tactics to scare parents out there, which is really dangerous in light of what's going on with public education. So stay tuned. Yeah. Thanks for allowing me to formally announce it. We were right on the precipice last time. So
exactly. Well, that sounds awesome. Should be very exciting. So everyone stay tuned for future videos from Viviana. And also stay tuned after the show for two things. Immediately after, we're to be diving deep with Jordan Yule on Twitch, twitch.tv/TYT. He will be diving deep. No guests, just vibes. Should be fun. Get yourself a pina colada and watch Jordan Yule dive deep into the news. And then it'll appear later on in the day, but right after the show, I'll be interviewing Congressman Ro Khanna. We'll be talking about his bill to finally actually fund the IRS so it can go after the wealthy individuals and corporations that have been getting away with murder. And we're also going to be talking about sort of some of our first topic on the show today, which is the battle to have the minimum wage increase be part of the COVID bill. He's been putting pressure on Biden and senators to do that. And so we'll be talking with him about that a little bit later on. So lots to get to on the show today. Thank you everybody for being here. Please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already so that people know that we're live. And as we go through this, we will be responding to your questions, concerns, comments, and all of that. And I also wanted to give a shout out to Avenger Dragon, apparently experiencing, as a lot of people in our audience are, some health difficulties. So our thoughts go out to you and thank you, you know, for being a part of our community. Now, with that, Viviana, you want to do this thing?
Let's do it. Got some it's important.
Bulky topics to jump into. Okay. The minimum wage increase has had a fraught battle to be included in the COVID aid bill. And unfortunately, people like Joe Biden, Kamala Harris seem all too willing to just do whatever the Senate parliamentarian says and boot it on down the road, a road where it seemingly has virtually no chance of actually being passed if it's not a part of this bill. Now, Bernie Sanders is an important figure in this battle because as the chair of the Senate budget committee, it's really up to him as to whether it's a part of that COVID aid bill. And so here at TYT, we've been trying to put pressure on him to not take it out with the hashtag don't kill it, Bernie. And it looks like, although we don't necessarily know in exactly what form, he is going to be forcing a vote on it, knowing that it might not pass, but that it will put every single senator, including especially every Democrat, on the record on this issue. And so he announced this tweeting at a time when millions of workers are earning starvation wages, when the minimum wage has not been raised by Congress since 2007 and stands at a pathetic $7.25 an hour. It is time to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. And on the what I call just an excuse, the parliamentarian is an excuse to not do it since they can be overridden. They have been removed in the past. If Kamala Harris wanted to do that, she could do that. She's not doing it, thus she doesn't want to do it. He says, my personal view is that the idea that we have a Senate staffer, a high ranking staffer, deciding whether 30 million Americans get a pay raise or not is nonsensical. We've got to make that decision, not a staffer who's unelected. So my own view is that we should ignore the rulings, the decision of the parliamentarian. And he said, to the best of my knowledge, there will be a vote on the minimum wage. We'll see what happens. I intend to offer the bill that will raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and we'll see how the votes go. If we fail in this legislation, I will be back. We're going to keep going. We are going to raise that minimum wage very shortly to $15 an hour. So we still have a lot to figure out what's going to happen, Viviana, but it looks like Bernie Sanders is not ready to give up on it as a part of this package just yet.
I mean, Bernie Sanders has never stopped fighting for the working people of this country, and we're so lucky to have him. But you know, Biden has been in office for just a couple of months now, and he's already broken several promises. You know, we are seeing some of the same behavior that we saw during the Great Depression when he was in office with Obama. You know, a lot of people lost their jobs back then. A lot of people never became employees again. They don't have any benefits anymore. I mean, this has been an ongoing problem for a while. And there was an excuse back then as to why they couldn't raise the minimum wage, because of the deficit, because of the recession, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And here we are, 2021, the future, and we're still in the same exact position. I mean, it's absolutely unheard of to expect people to live off of $7.25 an hour and get taxed heavily. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And it is something that should be put to a vote, because every single voter needs to know how their representative voted for this. Because I guarantee that, how many did you say? 30 million people, John? They need this money. They need this money. This is like life and death for these people. And this should be $25 an hour. 15 was the compromise like 10 years ago. And here we are, 2021, we're still dealing with $7.25 an hour. And you know, people assume that this is just your average kid going into McDonald's and working a fast food job. No, we have servers making $25 an hour. We have people who have been working at Walmart for decades, still making minimum wage. There are no benefits for these people. And we wonder why the country is falling into poverty. We wonder why there's a growing chasm between the 1% and the rest of us. And it's exactly for this reason, because they will continually exploit the working class just to continue to build wealth for the 1%. It is disgusting.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They need the money. And also importantly, they were promised the money. They were promised the money in advance of the November election. They were promised the money in advance of the special elections in Georgia. They've been promised by Biden, by Harris, by a whole bunch of them. And but the parliamentarian. That's why they can't do the thing that they promised.
Here we are, John. We're here, he's saying he's not gonna lower this. He's not gonna get rid of the student debt, 10,000. What is that, half a semester for most of these people?
Well, so Viviana, he's not gonna lower. I assume, so the reason that he's not doing that executive order, I have to assume, is the parliamentarian, right? I mean, after all, he could just sign an executive order. He's not doing it. What is your excuse in this particular case? And especially, by the way, let's say that you seriously are just like bowing down to the will of the parliamentarian. I really do want to do it, but they say that I can't. Okay, maybe as an act of good faith or like a show of good faith, do the one you can actually do. You could sign that executive order right now, but he's not. And so if that leads people to question his actual motivations, I can't imagine anything more reasonable than that.
I think we know what the motivations are, and it's what brought us Donald Trump. We are disillusioned with our current system, our current political system. Corporations have their hands deep into these guys' pockets, and they cannot move without approval. And it is something that we were afraid Biden was going to do. It was something that he promised he wasn't going to do, but now we already have broken promise after broken promise. We still have immigrant detention centers set up where they're putting kids. I mean, this is something he ran on. So it's really disgusting, because Biden was the compromise. Obviously, you and I were really pro Bernie. There was a lot of people. There's people marching in the streets, millions across the country. We want change. And it's not just the left, and it's not just progressives. The right needs change too. Mm-hmm. Now, because of racism and white supremacy, the right, that was a Freudian slip. The right has their own reasons who they want to blame. But really, at the end of the day, it comes down to the exploitation that capitalism requires. Yeah. And this is just another example of that.
Yeah. So what is going to be done to make sure that the minimum wage gets raised? Well, there are a couple of different options being laid out by a number of people who might be called upon to actually be a part of this process, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, who said that she favors a vote to overrule the parliamentarian. As well, she says, understand the only reason that we're in this mess is because of the filibuster. If we would get rid of the filibuster, then we wouldn't have to keep trying to force the camel through the eye of the needle. Instead, we would do what the majority of Americans want us to do. And in this particular case, that's raise the minimum wage. So she was both in favor of overruling the parliamentarian and also getting rid of the filibuster, because look, we're focused on this particular battle and this particular obstacle inside of this battle, very, very understandably. But once we get past this, we are then going to face an even bigger hurdle of the filibuster for everything else, because this at least is taking place under the umbrella of reconciliation. Future bills, for the most part, will not. And so we're gonna have to engage with that battle. We need to get as many people on the side of overruling the filibuster as possible. You know, some people who aren't necessarily in the Senate are also pushing for that. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says our two options are realistically this: override the parliamentarian or eliminate the filibuster. Those are the only two paths that we have in order to create substantive change in the United States. And that is what the people across the country want. But there are people who are not in favor of that, either because they say they just love the filibuster so much and the tradition of it, or that it's just, oh, your plan is too crazy, man. $15 an hour. Come on, Trotsky, what are you trying to do here? Well, AOC has a message for some, like Joe Manchin, who would say things like that.
Any, not just Senator Manchin, but any person who thinks that a $15 minimum wage is the crazy socialist agenda is living in a dystopian capitalist nightmare. And we should not prop that up. We should not continue that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Yeah, I think the belief and there are tons of people. Look, there are lots of wealthy people that have no interest in minimum wage workers getting more money. I sort of understand that cruelly and selfishly from a pragmatic point of view. But there are a bunch of people whose lives would be improved by this and other policy changes who have been convinced by the rich to not support economic policies that would actually benefit them. That is the dystopia that AOC is talking about there. And I think she's 100% right.
She's 1,000% right, per usual. Am I the only one that thought Joe Manchin was like the rich version of Joe the Plumber? Like, I was like, are they just saying like Joe Manchin, like your average one percenter? I mean, really, that's coming down to what he is. It's just Joe Manchin, you know? Yeah. You know, we are in a place right now where the right and even some moderate Democrats, which I'll just call conservatives, they are blaming, they're excusing it, they're justifying their reason against the minimum wages that's gonna hurt small businesses. And in some ways, it will be a challenge for small business, but you don't just do one thing. You increase the minimum wage and then you provide support for small businesses. But small businesses are suffering because we're giving too much support to big business. You know, you have companies like Costco already making strides and raising their minimum wage to $16 an hour, effective immediately. So you're telling me that Jeff Bezos can't do the same? Are you kidding me? Kirkland Signature is beating out Jeff Bezos?
Yeah, apparently. Now, in addition to Joe Manchin, in terms of these potential paths forward, here's a statement put out by the White House press secretary. President Biden is disappointed in this outcome about the parliamentarian, as he proposed having the $15 minimum wage as part of the American Rescue Plan. He respects the parliamentarian's decision and the Senate's process. He will work with leaders in Congress to determine the best path forward, because no one in this country should work full time and live in poverty. Okay, so maybe, you know, I want to be helpful. I want this to be a helpful show. So let's save Joe Biden a little bit of time. Okay, rather than him spending the next 6 weeks with a bunch of like people that barely want to make any progress on this, and then also the Republicans, I'll save you some time. If it's not in this, then you could try to pass it as a standalone bill, and the Republicans will filibuster it, and then you will have to either just back down or try to overrule the filibuster, in which case Chris Sinema and Joe Manchin won't support it unless you bludgeon them into supporting the overrule of the filibuster. That's it.
That's
there,
it.
Don't waste any time in Oval Office summits. You don't have to do it. That's the path. Now, we can do stuff about some of those later steps. Joe Manchin says that he will never support overruling the filibuster. Let's test that as a theory. Let's see what Joe Biden, as the leader of the Democratic Party, a unified Democratic Party that has, on the one hand, Joe Manchin's commitment to the filibuster, and on the other hand, all of the promises they've made, their entire political future, and the will of the American people. And let's mash those together and see who comes out on top.
Yeah.
We could do that. That's not what Joe Biden actually wants to do, by the way.
No, he's just fronting right now. He's just going through the motions to make it look like he really cares, and he doesn't. I mean, that's the bottom line. What is the point of having the majority in the House if we're going to be doing this? Because the Republicans used it to their advantage. They all came together in their crazy conspiracy theories, and they said, yeah, we'll buy into this. But yet, we have a very, we're talking about the Republican Party being fractured. We have a very fractured Democratic Party. And unfortunately, there's a lot of us who have to play into being part of it, even though we don't consider ourselves Democrats, just because otherwise we won't have a say. And so we have to really get together and figure out who we are as a Democratic Party, as opposed to the Republican Party. We know they're already off the rails. We don't need any more moderates. We don't need any more conservatives on this side. We got plenty on the other side. So maybe Joe Manchin needs to change his political affiliation, because he obviously is not for the people. I mean, I cannot believe that the people in his state are not backing this $15 an hour minimum wage. Now, I know that the big business in his state is not backing it. And this is a trend across the country and really globally. Workers' rights, the labor movement, has taken a real fall. I mean, we are no longer prioritizing the workers in this country. And we are the ones who have built this country, and we will be the ones to continue to build it. We have automation left and right. Target is still charging the same prices when you go in, and now I gotta check my own groceries. I don't even get a 401k or any part-time off. I gotta work there now. The prices are not going down, even though big business is having less overhead. So they want to complain and say that $15 an hour is going to break them. Let the mom and pops with less than 15 employees get a subsidy from the government so they can afford this. It's the same thing for the hero pay. They're trying to put on these grocery stores to pay the essential workers more. Well, the burden shouldn't fall just on these companies. The burden should fall on the federal government. They have the money, we know, because they're bailing out big business left and right, and the banks.
Yeah. Yeah.
The money is there.
We're gonna see.
Well, you know, John, tell me more about this filibuster, because how can we get rid of it? Is it just a vote? Because it's something that has grown into this monster at this point.
Exactly. Yeah. And we've talked about the history of it and everything. And it's not at all what they say. We can reiterate that at some point. Based on my understanding, in terms of how you would actually overrule it, is every Senate puts together its own package of rules for how the Senate is going to be run. What is going to be allowed, how debates are going to work, how committee assignments are going to work, a billion different things, most of which most people don't need to know. And one of them is effectively the set of rules that govern how filibusters work. It is no deeper than that. It's not in any law, it's not in the Constitution, it's nothing like that. It is just a thing in the rules, and the rules have been changed in the past. In the past, there was no 60 votes to break it. There was no cloture. That is a thing that was added. And why was it added? It was added because it turns out that having a minority of the elected officials able to determine everything that happens in the country is kind of a BS idea. And so they set this threshold. And if you can set it at 60 one day, you can set it differently. You could, in fact, even set it back at 50 if you want to. So we could actually do that. And if, look, if people want to stand up and give a long speech and draw attention to their opposition to a thing, they can do that. In theory, if they were actually willing to do that, we might not have to have this conversation. But the filibuster isn't what it was presented in black and white movies back in the 50s. It just isn't anymore. And so in theory, with a majority vote in the Senate, which the Democrats, if they were united, would win, they could eliminate the filibuster.
As they should.
Now, as they should. And we'll talk more about that. Let's talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, including some breaking news this morning about it. Lots of good news, although not necessarily as amazing good news as it might seem in one area. But overall, we got some good news for you. So one of the best things about this new vaccine, which has now been approved and is being rushed out all over the country, is that unlike the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines that are already in use and have been since late December, it requires only one shot for full protection. So that's pretty awesome. Now with the others, you take a shot and then several weeks to a month later, you go back and take a second one to get the full protection. This one is just one shot. Now that is beneficial for a couple of different reasons. One, you require less actual shots to be shipped and distributed and fewer appointments to be scheduled and all of that. There are also parts of the country where it is difficult to get to people twice. Also, in general, a lot of people drop off after their first vaccine in prior vaccine rollouts. In places like jails and things like this, it'll be easier to just swiftly vaccinate an entire place. So all of that is good, in addition to the fact that unlike Pfizer, Moderna, it doesn't require intense freezers and things like that. It can just be regularly refrigerated, so it's easier to store. Now, there are some bad things about it. So for instance, according to data released by the FDA last week, the clinical trials found an efficacy rate of about 72% in the US. But that's the number that only tells us about any symptomatic infection down to the sniffles or a short-lived fever. For hospitalizations and death, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine reported 100% effectiveness after 28 days. So initially, that 72 number, or some people are seeing 66, might scare you because it seems as if it is significantly less protective than prior vaccines. But in terms of the worst outcomes of COVID-19, it is 100% effective in the trials, at least in the numbers that we've seen. So that is certainly good news. There is, however, some bad news. So the company said that it would immediately ship nearly 4 million doses around the United States and a total of 20 million by the end of March, which is 17 million less than expected under its government contract. So they're about half where they should be at in terms of their manufacturing. Its current schedule calls for a recovery from those delays, with the company saying it's on track to deliver 100 million doses by the end of June. Now, if that comes true, and the fact that they've had these problems already means that maybe it won't, that would go a long way towards vaccinating a third of the entire country. Because again, 100 shots, 100 million doses is 100 million vaccinations, not like with Moderna and Pfizer where it's literally half that. So a little bit of good news, a little bit of bad news. Viviana, what do you think about the fact that we now have this third vaccine out there?
I mean, I think it's great. I think it's wonderful that it's one shot. And really the efficacy rate is similar, because when you take your first shot with the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine, you have about 85% coverage after roughly 3-4 weeks. And then you get your second shot and you get the 100%. So it's kind of similar to that. So I think it's better than nothing, especially because the people that are going to be getting this Johnson & Johnson shot are going to be less at risk than the people who have already gotten the Moderna and Pfizer shot. So theoretically, they need a little bit less protection, or they're, you know, but it sounds like they're going to get fully covered. What really disgusts me about this whole problem, this whole vaccine issue, is that it's still a money-making issue. I mean, Jonas Salk famously gave the polio vaccine to everybody, to the world, so that everybody could benefit from it. Why are we not in that same mindset? Why is it still this competition? And the Defense Production Act should just be in full force pumping out this vaccine. I mean, I have not seen the sort of infrastructure that I would expect from the federal government during wartime. I mean, they really mobilized in World War II and they interned Japanese and there was all kinds of stuff going on and war bonds and all these things. And it's like, well, we're gonna put some stuff in the States. But it really hasn't changed that much from when Trump was in office. I mean, there really isn't much of a difference.
So I do have an update on that, but you're not wrong. And the fact that if anything is being done, and something is being done that we're gonna talk about right now, it's starting now. So that's a problem which we'll describe. So this morning, President Biden announced that pharmaceutical giant Merck will help make Johnson & Johnson's single shot coronavirus vaccine. Under the arrangement, Merck will dedicate two facilities in the US to producing the shots. One will provide fill finish services, the last stage of the production process during which the vaccine substance is placed in vials and packaged for distribution. The other will actually make the vaccine itself and has the potential to vastly increase supply, perhaps even doubling what Johnson & Johnson could make on its own. Now, this is not the sort of thing that normally happens. Normally, companies like Merck do not produce other vaccines for other companies. This is apparently a deal that was brokered by the Biden administration, which is great news. However, Trump should have done this. We should not be like now setting up these deals. We already have a delay in rolling out the vaccine because we didn't already do this. And by the way, Biden announcing this is great news eventually, because it could take up to 2 months to get the fill finish plant ready and a few more months to equip the other facility to actually make the vaccine. Yeah. So that will be good news, but why weren't those facilities ready to go? They should have been ready in December, let alone in March, let alone now we gotta wait until the late spring. So add this to the list of things that if Trump gave a damn about any of this, we could have been ready with facilities like this scattered across the country. We certainly have the money for it, but we didn't. And so you getting vaccinated or me getting vaccinated is gonna needlessly take months longer than it should. And during that, a lot more people are gonna die. February was better than March, but over 70,000 people still died in the US during February. It's entirely possible that March will be just as bad as the highly contagious variants of the COVID virus continue to spread across America. We could be fully vaccinated in a month or two if this work had already been done. But again, no, it just wasn't, and that's totally cool. It's apparently not illegal in any way to totally hamstring a country's response to the worst disaster it's had in our entire life. And so this is good news, but it's only sort of good news. It's like a kind of a silver lining and only one that's gonna manifest in a few months from now.
I mean, 100 years ago with the Spanish flu, we lost 500,000 people. Here we are 100 years later, science, technology through the roof, still 500,000 people. I mean, what are we doing here? Now, there's a lot of synergistic variables that are playing into why people are a little bit more laissez-faire, including politicians, because it's not affecting children as much as it is an elderly population. Now, people really freaked out during the Spanish flu because kids were dropping like flies, so there was a little bit more of a panic. Well, obviously, we don't want to just shrug off our elderly population. And it really, I don't even want to blame Trump, honestly, John, because there's a lot of people that could have had these wheels in motion. And this guy, Trump, really didn't give and care about anything. So if he had the right people talking in his ear who really cared about this country, who are still in office, by the way, Trump may be gone, but these people are still in power. We're already seeing them. We talked about the minimum wage and how they're holding back support for the American people. This is just another example of that. And I'm a little bit interested to know what sort of deal Biden made with Merck. What was the compromise? Is it gonna be, don't worry, I won't push Medicare for all. Don't worry, you're still gonna get paid down the road. You know, these are the kinds of backdoor dealings that we don't know how that goes, of governing, as they call it. You know, so we're gonna find out what sort of deals were made and why, what sort of sacrifices we have to do.
If it's any reassurance to you, Viviana, I don't think that Biden needed to reassure Merck that he wasn't gonna push for Medicare for all. I think they were sure about that already. But yeah, I get what you're saying. We wouldn't know, we can't know, but I'm assuming a lot of money. In this particular case, I'm, you know, in the absence of overhauling our entire medical system, I'm okay with some money going out if it's actually gonna result in people receiving the vaccine, especially considering the populations that are being worst devastated by COVID. Yeah,
I honestly believe, and this is really disgusting, but I do believe politicians have considered the benefit of losing our elderly population as how much less it'll cost them in social security. And it's ugly to say, but that's really where we're at in this country with predatory capitalism and how we can save. They've already been trying to slash social security benefits anyway. And so here we have 500,000 people dead, and a lot of them over 65. So these are our retirees. I said this from the beginning, and I still stand by the fact that I think that this is a loss that they're willing to take.
Well, we got a lot of other news to get to. So I'm gonna move on to the next topic. Jeez, every day a new update on this. Let's talk about it. Governor Cuomo is facing yet another woman describing her experience of harassment at his hands. And because of that, calls for his resignation have intensified. His third woman accused him of offensive behavior, saying he touched her face and back and asked to kiss her moments after they met at a wedding reception. When she removed his hand with her own, the woman said the governor remarked that she seemed aggressive and placed his hands on her cheeks. He asked if he could kiss her loudly enough for a friend standing nearby to hear. Ms. Rook was bewildered by the entreaty, she said, and pulled away as the governor drew closer. I was so confused and shocked and embarrassed. Her account was corroborated by a friend. She says, I turned my head away and didn't have words in that moment. I mean, it's certainly good that her account was corroborated, but to be fair, it was also photographed, as you can see here. So she doesn't look to be enjoying that interaction with the governor. So a spokesperson for the governor didn't directly address the account, but referred to a general statement that Mr. Cuomo released on Sunday night, in which he acknowledged that some things he had said have been misinterpreted as an unwanted flirtation. So we can add this to the list. When you grab a woman by the side of her face and say, "Can I kiss you?" you might misinterpret that as flirtation.
It's disgusting. There is not anything more disrespectful than putting your hands on somebody, and putting your hands on someone's face is a very dominant behavior. It's how dogs communicate with each other. They stand on each other, they lick faces. Those aren't kisses, that's dominance. Yeah. And clearly Cuomo is not very far off than animalistic dominant behavior. You know, this is the power that this is the problem with powerful people. And we don't have a lot of women in power, but there has been cases of women exhibiting or wielding their power over others in this same sort of sexual domination way. But it's not some rampant issue, because we live in a patriarchy and the majority of the people that have power are men. So we're seeing this really affecting women across the country and across the globe. I mean, I myself have been subject to this behavior countless times. In many jobs, and there's women, and I'm not sure if this was a woman who was working with him as an aide, wanted to work with him, or if there was there's another aide that was working with him that also was subjected to this type of behavior. So this is just, how hard is it, no pun intended, but how hard is it for you to just leave these people alone that you work with? Consider them family. They are not there for you to be entertained. They are not there because they're in proximity, that doesn't mean they're free game. And we heard it from Trump's mouth. Grab them by the, you can do whatever you want when you're famous. They let you do whatever you want. It is disgusting, and it's so funny to me that we've had, you know, the Democratic Party, a lot of the, you know, oh, how dare he? Oh, this is terrible. But yet they're doing the same exact thing. And what's worse about Governor Cuomo's behavior is that he tried to backpedal it, like, whoa, I thought I misunderstood. No, you didn't. You think you can do whatever you want to anybody because you're in power. And that is why you did what you did. And you should have stepped up and said, you know what? That was wrong what I did. I took advantage of the fact that I thought that I could do whatever I want. And you know what, should he resign, should he not, at least he would have come up and said, you know what, I messed up. And that is what we expect of our politicians and our leaders. He did not do that, and that is why he's in worse trouble right now, because he tried to backpedal it and minimize and diminish what these women were feeling. And I have been in that position, and it is very difficult to stand up for yourself. Now, I'm an older woman, older than 20, early 20s. When you're, that's young, John. to be able to be assertive enough. And then she was assertive and he accused her of being aggressive. This is what happens when women assert ourselves and we say no, then we get blamed, then we're a bitch, then we're a prude, then we're all these names that they call us and they continue to push us. And that's dominance too. So this is just another example of it. It is.
Well, it's like gaslighting too. It's like, imagine like taking someone by the side of their face and saying, stop being aggressive. No, she's not grabbing your face, dude. Yeah, and like the apology, no, when you take someone's face in your hands and ask if you can kiss them, they're not misinterpreting anything. No. That was what it is. Now, you can say you weren't actually trying to have sex with her, but you were definitely flirting with her. So don't gaslight people about what you're doing. And if you do, it is no longer an apology. It is
that's
an
not
invasion,
flirting, John.
It might be an excuse.
That's not flirting. That's not flirting.
But when I use that word, it's 100%. Everything he's doing is inappropriate. He shouldn't be doing any of that. He shouldn't also be lying about what he's doing. He is trying to engage sexually with her. That's what he's trying to set up. It was not a misinterpretation. It was not just some joke that had nothing to do with sex. It was 100% tied in with sex. And he needs to understand. Now, he could have come out and said, I've done tons of stuff that I was wrong to believe was appropriate. It wasn't appropriate. It's not appropriate now. It wasn't appropriate then. And I pledged to never do anything like that. He could, in theory, do that. And then people could evaluate whether that's good enough. But that's not what he's doing. And so, do you think, I mean, let's say we don't know if more accounts are going to come out. I would assume there are probably more accounts out there based on what he's done. Do you think he is going to make it past this, that in a couple of weeks, it's just not going to be a story anymore? You do?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Why? Because they always do, John. The Me Too movement came, everybody screamed about it, and then where is it now? I see women getting treated like this all the time. There is no accountability. There are no consequences. And this will get swept under the rug. This will get sort of pardoned by his party. And he will come up with another statement that maybe resembles what you just said. And well, meanwhile, we have, you know, celebrities and such that have, you know, pauses put on their career. Louis C.K., he didn't rape anybody except for rape their eyes. And it's the same thing with Cuomo. You don't have to actually kiss somebody to humiliate them. It is a humiliating feeling to have a man or anybody in power. I don't even want to genderize it. It is humiliating to have somebody in power who she probably was excited to meet, like, oh, I'm going to meet the governor.
Maybe.
And then he does this to her. It is humiliating. I've left jobs because of it. I've been fired because of it. I mean, it has happened to me countless times. And I know it is happening across the country to so many women in particular. And I know that there's some outliers of men that had been subject to this behavior as well. And I'm not condoning that just because they're men. It is really the exploitation of your power that you know that you can get away with this kind of stuff. I mean, Trump, through his disgust and honesty, he said it flat out. And he doesn't apologize for that behavior. I do not want to hear one Republican saying anything about Cuomo, not because it's not wrong, because they condoned this behavior years ago. So zip your lips now.
Exactly. Yeah, I largely agree. I think he's probably going to make it through. And not everyone does. Some Democrats have stepped down. I mean, Katie Hill, Al Franken. There's been a couple, but that's really about it. And almost
not the level of power he has. Not at this level.
I mean, Al Franken was a senator, but they also knew that they could easily replace him with another Democrat. I mean, in theory, you could do that with Cuomo as well. But I get what you're saying. I think he's going to be just fine.
Yeah, sadly.
Now,
and you know who won't be? These women, John, that's who won't be just fine. They're gonna come out here, they're gonna get raked through the coals, and then they're gonna get nothing. Maybe they'll get some measly settlement or something like that. Meanwhile, they're humiliated and they're gonna have a black mark next to their name, just like Monica Lewinsky.
You're crazy, Viviana. They do this to get famous. That's why they do it. All these women are just looking to get famous because who wouldn't want it to be the thing you're known
for? We have no recourse, John. I was sexually harassed by my boss a couple of years ago. He actually did kiss me. He offered me cocaine. He asked me to go to his hotel room. This is after I had already worked for him successfully for a year. And we were renegotiating my contract. He wasn't going to give me a raise. And all of a sudden, he came on to me. I knew that I had no recourse other than to walk away from that job. Sure, I could have fought it, went to court, do this thing. I knew that I wasn't going to get anything out of it. I had to just move on. And these are the sacrifices women make all the time. And we're out there trying to commit, we're trying to compete with in our careers out there. And a lot of men will say, oh, they use their sexuality to get advanced. Maybe that is the case, but what else do they have? They're trying to get ahead in a world that has their shoe on their neck. Anyway, I could go on for hours about this, John, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm very passionate about it.
There will be future powerful men that we'll have to discuss. Don't worry about that. Yeah. Representative Madison Cawthorn, like the youngest person ever to be a representative, also has some other noteworthy things about his personal history. So let's jump into it. In October, more than 150 former students at the college that he went to signed onto a letter blasting the then candidate for his behavior during his stint at the school, which they wrote, quote, was marked by gross misconduct toward their female peers. During his brief time at the college, Cawthorn established a reputation for predatory behavior. His MO was to invite unsuspecting women on joy rides in his white Dodge Challenger. Cawthorn would take young women to secluded areas, lock the doors, and proceed to make unwanted sexual advances. The letter also noted that women at the school were warned not to be alone with him. One student taken on one of these fun rides, as he called them, says she felt something was off and shut down the conversation. She said then he got really upset and he whipped the car around and started going back to campus at 70 to 80 miles an hour on these one lane roads. And it was really scary. I can imagine that's the case. In addition to the claims from those Patrick Henry students, at least two women have also alleged that he forcibly kissed or touched them years ago, claims that he has previously denied. He told CNN last year that he regretted actions he took and apologized to anybody he had made feel uncomfortable. But note that he also at one point said he's never done anything sexually inappropriate. So it's interesting to apologize for the things you did, but then also to claim I am unimpeachable when it comes to my sexual morality. So which is it, buddy? But we know which it is. Imagine you could not find 150 people at my college of UConn that even remember that I was there. And yet he has over 150 people saying, oh no, that guy was a predator. Everybody knew to watch out for him. What do you have to do to establish a reputation like that for yourself, Viviana?
We just heard. He practically kidnapped women and took them to secluded areas where he intended to rape them. That's what he did. And I like people were warned about him, because then it's your fault for getting into the car with him. You were warned, so you're not a victim. You were a willing participant. You knew he was a psycho. You knew people told you he was going to do those things and he was a sexual predator. So this is your fault. That's exactly what "we warned you" means. I mean, a lot of people, you know, it's difficult because obviously there's a sensitivity when you're dealing with somebody who uses a wheelchair. You're like, okay, well, perhaps, you know, we'll give this person the benefit of the doubt. You know, unfortunately, that's not the case. You have to hold everybody to the same standard. And, you know, this guy has to be responsible. But again, like we were just talking about in Cuomo, there's no consequences for this kind of behavior. You know, in my situation and in other situations, there was no rape. So in this case, if there's no rape, then nothing happened. So you can't be violated.
Unwanted sexual touching, I mean, I would argue is—
it's minimized.
Is in that category.
I agree. That's assault in my opinion. You're touching me in a sexual way. I don't care if there's penetration or there isn't. That is assault, but that is not how it's categorized by other people. It is downplayed. Well, they didn't know. They didn't know that groping was wrong. Do you grope your mother? Do you take your sister out into a secluded area and try to kiss her? It's wrong. And if you were confused, then you should say, oh, I'm so sorry. Let me take you home. Not let me speed back and scare the living lights out of you because I'm threatening you now because you are whatever negative thing he wants to call her because she didn't play along and made him feel rejected. This is especially in college campuses. I mean, this is rampant. I remember when the Me Too movement just started and my little cousin was over at my house and I said, you know, this happens a lot. Has this ever happened to you? She proceeded to tell me, she said no. And then said, well, she proceeded to tell me a story about how she got really blackout drunk one time in college and she woke up with a guy having sex with her. She got scared and she left. She didn't consider that rape, John. She didn't consider that assault. She considered that her fault for getting too drunk. This is what's happening. This is what needs to change. We need to continue to educate the population about not objectifying yourself or others, because this is the kind of behavior that gets into this snowballed way. And men do not get to have a free pass because they're famous or they're powerful or they're using a wheelchair. No free passes, sorry.
Yeah, I would argue we should have even more expectations for people who want to be political leaders, that want to actually lead congressional districts. Now, look, a lot of the stuff that we saw, including his comments, the fact that he sped back the calling of joyrides, that might lead you to believe that he doesn't take this seriously. And to that effect, in response to the latest allegations, his office released a statement on Monday saying, "The voters of Western North Carolina responded to these allegations by giving Madison Cawthorn a 12-point victory over his opponent."
And a high five.
If you believe that he doesn't actually care about this, I think that's all the confirmation you need. No, that's the new thing, by the way. What's that?
We have a rapist in the Supreme Court.
Yeah. No, but he's on, so it's good. And Trump said the stuff that he said, but then he got elected, so it doesn't count anymore. That is what we always hear. If there are enough awful people in America that don't care about these things, then they're not illegal anymore. They're not immoral anymore. There's nothing wrong if there's enough a-holes in America that are okay with the crap that you've done as a person. Okay, well, maybe you can get elected, and maybe Madison Cawthorn can get reelected, even after we're going to tell you all the other stuff that's going on with him. But we're still going to point it out, because America may not have higher expectations for its leaders, but we at the very least do.
Amen. Now, it's not like getting. Yeah, let's go, because this guy is dirty as it gets.
Yeah, he's gonna do some. I mean, he's done a million crazy things in his life. He's like a Marjorie Greene. He might be marginally more intelligent. He's gonna do something absolutely insane. Like, he's gonna cross some sort of line with Nazis or something like that, that they're gonna end up kicking him out if the Republican Party ever comes to its senses. But let's see. Here's a fun one. A former close friend of Madison Cawthorn told the Washington Post the lawmaker lied about a car wreck that partially paralyzed him. Cawthorn's account of the 2014 wreck was that a close friend had crashed the car in which he was a passenger, leaving him to die in a fiery tomb. The friend told the newspaper in his first public comments about the crash that he pulled Cawthorn from the wreckage. Quote, "It hurt very badly that he would say something as false as that. That's not at all what happened. I pulled him out of the car the second that I was able to get out of the car." By the way, his parents disagreed with his account of the wreck, and then he would go on to say he doesn't remember it. I would say that if you don't remember a traumatic experience like that, don't assert that another person left you to die.
Go ahead, John.
Well, no, you go first. We've got some more to add to that. But
I just was going to say, this is another example of him gaslighting, the same as when he, was assaulting those women. Then now he's the victim. Again, here he's the victim. Someone was out there trying to help him, but he twists things in his mind because he's a narcissist. And a sociopath, apparently. I mean, he doesn't believe, he's just making up his own reality.
Yeah, so let's see. He claimed that he was declared dead after the wreck. He wasn't. The police report noted he was incapacitated, but it sounds cooler if you say that you were declared dead, I guess. He also said that he was preparing before the crash to start studies at the US Naval Academy, a boast that he made a campaign ad about. But then they had to admit that he had actually been rejected by the Naval Academy before the crash. Because why not lie about every aspect of this if it helps your political career? He also, by the way,
go ahead. What else did he do?
He lied for a really long time about the fact that he was supposedly training to compete in the Paralympic Games. And actual Paralympians say that everything he said about that is a complete joke, and that he's basically making a mockery of what they do. By claiming that, like, oh no, I was totally training, I was gonna be in it. No, you weren't, you had nothing to do with it. Like, I can go for a jog, it doesn't mean I'm training for the Olympics. That's not how it works, because the Olympics are serious. You know what else is serious? The Paralympic Games. You don't get to treat it as if it's some sort of joke for a campaign ad that some casual person, like, banging out a couple miles on a Saturday is in serious international contention. That isn't how it works, unless you think it is a joke.
He does.
But anyway, he they love him. They love him. Why? Because he got elected, and the first thing he tweeted after he got elected was "cry more lib." Okay, but like, you're victimizing people. You're making a mockery of people's lives. That's not libs crying. Those are your constituents. God only knows some of those students that he violated might be his constituents. And certainly, so far, he's evaded any real responsibility for this. And I understand Trump did a lot of crazy stuff after the election. Marjorie Greene has been really crazy. You know who else is awful? Madison Cawthorn. And let's not have that lost in the shuffle.
Absolutely. And you're right. They're taking advantage of this sort of trend of being awful and despicable as being, this is powerful. We're going to stand up for ourselves. Nobody's going to go on a witch hunt for me. And you got to be, this is back to accountability. There's no consequences for this kind of behavior. And it's disgusting. And a lot of people are sensitive on how they're going to respond to him because he uses a wheelchair. Well, you still are a leader in your community. You still have to be accountable to your constituents. And here we are, a guy who's going to continue to victimize himself. He's going to continue to make boastful claims. I mean, this is the kind of guy, you already know, the frat boy in college. He goes and takes girls for joyrides and tries to, it's the same mentality. Trump is a frat boy. This guy's a frat boy. Marjorie Greene wishes she was a frat boy. I don't know what her story is, but this guy might be one of your garbage people of the week, John.
Oh, I was just going to read, actually. T minus on Twitch says, guess what, Cawthorn? You just made the TDR garbage person of the week poll. Yeah, you did.
I agree.
I mean, yeah. The thing that's going to require a little bit of thought, though, is for our producer, for which of these things do you put him on the list? Because he also is quoted as, he was in a car ride, and multiple people in the car ride said, he loudly started a conversation about which race of girls gives the best blowjobs. And it wasn't a rhetorical question. And he wasn't really curious what other people's opinion was. He just started listing the order he thought were best at it. So just to give you an idea of the sort of person that this actually is.
That's
And
disgusting.
I'm sure, yes, we will be talking more about him because if you're a left politician, like you're an AOC, you might go in and let's say that you wanted more attention. You would, for instance, propose the Green New Deal. You would work on legislation. For them, there's nothing like that. There is only what is the awful thing you're going to say? What are you going to do to get the spotlight back on you? And so that is the game right now that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and Madison Cawthorn are going to be playing. They all want to be the shiniest, glitteriest a-hole in Congress. And so they're going to be competing with each other in a race to the bottom. And it's going to be really disgusting along the way.
This comes back to the right really trying to mock being politically correct and evolving as a society and moving past some of the despicable things that we turned our heads to, you know, before. This is another example of them wanting to go back to the good old days where you could just slap a waitress on the butt or do whatever you want. And there's no consequences. This is what they want to go back to. And it's really shocking that a lot of women are going up to bat for these kinds of men. Because guess what, ladies? You're going to get the short end of the stick. And I'm talking about you, Crawford. We know it's the short end of the stick.
Also going on the garbage people of the week list.
I couldn't help it.
Okay, let's see. We're gonna quickly do our last story. We're gonna see what happened with the poll after that, because this is important. So we're gonna try to fit this in what remains of the hour. So let's launch directly into this. Back during the 2020 Democratic primary, there were some big ideas thrown around, and one of the biggest was the wealth tax potentially being instituted in the United States. Elizabeth Warren was a big champion of the wealth tax, and then unfortunately, for a bunch of months, you didn't hear much about it. And look, any wealth tax in the United States is going to have a very hard road to passage that necessarily would have to go past the filibuster. But at least now it is being talked about once again because a slew of Democrats on Capitol Hill, including Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, on Monday proposed a 3% total annual tax on wealth exceeding $1 billion. They also called for a lesser 2% annual wealth tax on the net worth of households and trusts ranging from $50 million to $1 billion. So I will say to the audience first, before I give more details, whenever something like this is in the news, there are going to be a lot of incredibly wealthy people in the media that are going to try to scare you into being terrified of it because it's going to devastate your personal finances. Well, everyone watching this who has a net worth of 50 million or more, raise your hands. No?
Shrinking okay, then you're down, good.
Okay. Viviana? 50 million?
Well,
keep it up if you're at a billion. No? Okay, I think that we'll be okay then. So I'm gonna have some more details. I just wanna, let me read this one quote from Elizabeth Warren. She says, the ultra rich and powerful have rigged the rules in their favor so much that the top 0.1% pay a lower effective tax rate than the bottom 99%. And billionaire wealth is 40% higher than before the COVID crisis began. Thus, I think they can probably afford it. We will have more details on this, but Viviana, what do you think about this?
I just wanna say one thing. First of all, yes, tax the rich. And this is the other thing I wanna say. They're taxing unemployment wages. They're taxing unemployment wages and they're not taxing the rich. $50 million, and it's not, you're not gonna get taxed on the 50 million you have. It's the next dollar. So it's when you have 50 million and $1, that $1 is gonna be taxed 2 cents or whatever it is. You kidding me? This is an argument? This is how predatory capitalism has taken over. We have a history of breaking up monopolies and breaking up trusts and taxing the rich. There was an obligation for them to be more benevolent and build libraries and universities. I haven't seen them do this lately.
Yeah.
This hasn't happened. And it was still corrupt back then. It still was better off. So this is something that should be a no-brainer. Absolutely do it. I don't know who's gonna vote against it. Are you kidding me that it's gonna ruin you?
I can think of a lot of people that would vote
I mean the people.
Sure. Yeah. Although, you know, look, I should be fair because I did that joke about wanting to make sure that people know that it wouldn't affect them or whatever, but it would affect some people. About 100,000 people, actually. About 1 in 1,000 families. And I know, look, I reassured the non-millionaires and billionaires. So let me reassure those 100,000 Americans. So do you know what you get? You take one of you and add this wealth tax. So for instance, let's say you take a billionaire and then you add this wealth tax. Do you know what you get? A billionaire still, and they're gonna be just fine. They're gonna have 3% less per year, but they're gonna make more than that. It's literally not even contracting their wealth over time. It is only limiting the rate of expansion. Do you know what you can't buy as a billionaire after the wealth tax that you could have bought before? Because I don't know the moon. I don't know what actual effect it has on your life. Now, it would have an effect. It could generate something like $78 billion a year that in theory could provide a big jump towards switching over to Medicare for all. It could pay for universal 4 years of public college for literally everyone that wants access to it, which would generate untold benefits to the country at large. In terms of those top 100 people, it would have no effect whatsoever on their actual lives. Maybe they would, it would mess with their like financial dick measuring competition, I suppose, but it would affect them all. So it wouldn't even really mess with that. So it's a great idea. And because it's a great idea and because it would help the working class, it almost certainly isn't gonna pass. But you know, at least kudos to Sanders and Warren for bringing it up once again.
I mean, I think we should just tell them what the rich tell millennials who are having trouble saving money. Stop buying avocado toast, AKA mansions. Don't buy a yacht, okay? Sorry, you might not be able to get the yacht you want. You know, this should be a pride in being an American and or having a corporation, having a business in the United States. This should be a pride that you have to be able to give back to your country. There should be some sort of patriotism tied to this, but no. We're not about that. We're about capitalism. And it is appalling to say that somebody can't be as rich as they want. How dare we tax them? We're taxing unemployment as income. This is money that people are barely scraping by. And then they gotta go and pay their taxes and pay taxes on this. And we're complaining about 2 cents after $50 million? I mean, this is such a chasm between the working class and the 1%. We can't even fathom the amount of wealth they have. These are not even rich people. These are wealthy people that come from generational wealth. This will not break them, even if they have a bad year the next year. And guess what? Then you won't be taxed. Maybe you go below 50 million. You'll be all right.
It's a great hypothetical, but look at the worst year we've had. It didn't break them. They're doing fine. Elon Musk is worth way more than he was beforehand. So no,
people right now in this country are in line for food banks and the other group are buying Teslas. I mean, this is where we're at. This is such a dichotomy right now, and we have to do something about it. And this is exactly what we need to do. So of course, we applaud Warren and we applaud Bernie, and we really hope that this makes a move. We have a majority. We need to make this kind of progress in this country, or who knows what's going to happen in 4 years, Trump or not. I mean, the Democratic Party is almost as conservative as the Republican Party at this point.
And by the way, like, this is the conversation we should be having about something like this. And we're having a conversation about, like, can we finally raise the minimum wage? What a failed state we live in.
It's exactly right.
But anyway, well, we've reached the end of the show. So let's find out what happened with the poll. We asked you today, do you believe that a $15 an hour minimum wage will pass as part of the COVID aid bill? And what do you know? 35% of you think that it will be included. I actually would have expected that number to be lower. Now that does leave 65% who think it will be removed, but I thought it would be 10 to maybe 15%. So look at the optimism in the audience today, Viviana.
Progressives are notoriously optimistic, but I think that's true. I think you and I both, well, Biden said, what was it, 3 weeks ago, that it wasn't going to be in there. And then the press secretary backpedaled that. He already said he wasn't going to put it in there. Oh, I don't think it's going to make it in there. He already decided. This is all just front.
Well, thank you to everybody who did the poll. We're going to do them pretty much every Tuesday. So just a fun little thing we can do. By the way, just a couple quick comments before we close things out. Black Mamba said, YouTube member said, I love how John gets extra feisty when Viviana co-hosts. I didn't know that I was, but maybe indeed I did. And $27 on Twitch says, I like this lady. Never seen her before. Well, you'll see more of her. And why is that, Viviana? Why will they see more of you?
You can catch my new weekly, possibly more segments with the Young Turks on Rebel HQ Facebook and all of the Young Turks Facebook channels. And of course, hopefully I'll be back here on the Damage Report with Mr. John Iderola. Thanks for having
me. Thank you as always.
And my own show, Contextualize This, on YouTube and Facebook as well. So I have a great interview I just did with a professor about the, now I just went blank on it. That was such a great interview.
It blew just her mind.
It's going to be good, guys.
Awesome. And thank you as always for being on. Love to have you here.
Thank you, John. Thanks.
If it's working properly, the IRS is supposed to make sure that everyone is paying their taxes, that people aren't evading paying their taxes by breaking the law and all of that. But unfortunately, for quite a while, it has not been working properly. And that is because it has been purposefully defunded over the course of a number of years. Well, now there is a bill that is going to attempt to fix that. And we are very lucky to be joined by the representative putting forward the bill. Representative Ro Khanna joins us once again. Representative Khanna, thank you for being here.
I'm great to always be on.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about your legislation.
Well, it's very simple. Right now, the IRS actually audits someone making $25,000 in Mississippi, in Delta, Mississippi, more than they audit people who are making millions on Park Avenue. That is wrong. What our bill does is it beefs up the IRS's auditing department, and it says you need to audit the top 1% and the big corporations, many of whom who are simply evading tax, not avoiding it, evading it, by not properly disclosing all of their income. And the study showed that this would raise $1.2 trillion over 10 years. This isn't some liberal economist. This is Larry Summers and Natasha Sarin saying, just collect the tax, you can raise $1.2 trillion.
And the $1.2 trillion, that's effectively getting the corporations and some individuals to pay the taxes that they've legally been owing for a long period of time. They're just not paying, correct?
Exactly. I mean, it's the way they do it is they have business income and they don't show the business income, and the IRS, because they don't audit them, never gets at this business income. So this isn't some clever lawyer scheme of finding some loopholes. This is just simply lying on your taxes. It'd be as if you made $75,000 and you put down on the IRS that you made $60,000. Now, most people, they have a W-2. You know, as a congressman, you get a W-2, and so it's hard to do. But if you have a lot of assets and if you have business activity, then there are ways that you can not pay all your taxes. And the only way to get after that really is an audit.
And as you pointed out, I mean, anybody, any random person who might be watching the show, they can potentially be audited. For the vast majority of people who are not bringing in millions or billions of dollars, this is unlikely to have much of an effect on them, I assume.
Right. I mean, it says that you have to do the audits on the top 1% because that's where a lot of the evasion is. And right now, the IRS spends more effort going after people who are getting the earned income tax credit and claiming two people are claiming the same child. And we're going after things like that instead of going where the revenue is. And the revenue is in the top 1% and the big corporations who are not disclosing their income. And this should be something that even Republicans are for. I mean, we can argue about the marginal tax rates. You can argue about the corporate tax rates. But who's for allowing some people not to play by the rules? I mean, it would be like saying, well, some people, you know, you don't have to, you can foul in basketball and it doesn't matter. I mean, that's so contrary to the American ethos.
Well, I think it's interesting that you asked that question because perhaps if it goes up for vote, we might find out. Because look, what you're talking about is people have been avoiding paying their due. This is what they're legally obligated to do. And it raises a lot of money without actually having to raise taxes, both of which are things that in theory everyone would support. But so far as you've been sort of pushing this forward, in terms of the Republican caucus and also the Democrats, what has the reception been like? Are you seeing any Republicans who are interested in potentially co-sponsoring this or anything like that?
There's been some interest. We haven't gotten Republicans yet. I mean, the big thing they say is, oh, you're putting too much of a burden by auditing the 1%. Why are you singling them out? And I say, well, the data shows that they should be singled out because that's where a lot of the evasion is taking place. But, you know, that is the counter argument that are you empowering the IRS and the agency? But in my view, most Americans want people to play by the same rules.
And were this to come up for a vote, what is your feeling right now in the House and in the Senate? You know, let's assume that in the Senate you might not get some Republicans. Theoretically, you could, but if you wouldn't, is this something that you think at least all of the Democrats would be unified behind?
I do, but I think so much depends on the president, and that's why we're working on trying to get this into the president's agenda. The president is looking for easy ways to raise revenue. Look, I support Senator Warren's wealth tax. I think it's long overdue. That is a position that is gonna be tough to get the whole caucus behind. This should be a no-brainer. I think this is such a low-hanging fruit. When I read Natasha Sorin and Larry Summers' paper, I couldn't believe that it would raise that much money. It seemed too good to be true. So this seems like such an easy thing for the Democrats to get behind.
Well, speaking of things that should be easy for the Democrats to get behind, I'd like to transition to our second topic. The increase to the minimum wage is something that Democrats promised in advance of the general election last November, as well as the special elections in Georgia. Now, about a week ago, the parliamentarian in the Senate advised that it could not be included as part of the COVID aid bill. And now we've got this divide where Joe Biden, Kamala Harris are not interested in overriding the parliamentarian. Some in the Senate, like Bernie Sanders, are saying that it should be done. Elizabeth Warren saying it should be done. And Bernie is promising that there will be a vote on this minimum wage increase. What do you think about the current divide between those sides?
Well, there's no reason to follow the parliamentarian's advice. I actually don't demonize the parliamentarian. It's not the parliamentarian's fault. Her job is to give advice, but we can't hide behind the parliamentarian advice when in this case, the advice is wrong. I mean, the minimum wage has a budget impact. It clearly does. The CBO found that it did. And all it takes is for the presiding chair, in this case, Vice President Harris, to say that it does have a budget impact. It's so much easier to do this than to overturn the filibuster or the Byrd rule. This is actually keeping all that in place. And then it allows for a vote on an increase in the minimum wage. Here's the important thing to note. It's not just if you want to raise it to $15, which we all do and think is the floor. It's even if you want to raise it to $12 or $13, you can't do any of that without it being ruled in reconciliation. The alternative is to try to get 60 votes. You're not going to get 10 Republicans to vote for something when you can't even get a single Republican to vote on the COVID relief. That's why this is such a big fight. If we don't overrule the parliamentarian, we're basically saying it's going to take 60 votes to increase the minimum wage.
So I know that I believe Mitt Romney supports, I think it was a $10 an hour. So you don't think that at 11 or 12 or 13, anything like that, you'd be able to get enough to actually not you, you're not in the Senate, but in the Senate right, to be able to surpass a filibuster?
I think it'd be very tough. I mean, maybe you could get Romney, but $10 seems awfully inadequate. And then what are we going to do? Yeah. Go another decade without raising it again? So I don't think that's what we ought to settle for. And it's actually not clear to me that you would even get McConnell allowing 10 Republicans to vote for that in a standalone bill. So the point is that it's important to distinguish two issues. One is the $15 wage, which all of the progressives are going to fight for. But even those people who are not for the $15 wage should be rooting for Kamala Harris to disregard the parliamentarian decision, because if she doesn't do that, you're even ruling out the possibility of a more moderate senator saying, let's raise it to $12. So let's at least have the conversation and have a vote on increasing the wage. Otherwise, you're really leaving it up to the whims of 10 Republicans.
So you alluded to it as sort of hiding behind the parliamentarian earlier. I certainly see it as hiding, but my question is why? Why hide behind the parliamentarian if it is something that you've campaigned on and say that you support? Is it that it's considered too divisive to overrule the parliamentarian? It would look bad. Is it a belief that somehow it could pass as a standalone bill facing an obvious filibuster from the Republicans? So if it is hiding, what is the purpose of the hiding? Why are they doing that?
I think there's a concern that it would upset the institutions and the rules of the Senate, and people would blame the Democrats for blowing up the institution. I don't think that's what it's doing. It's not even overturning the filibuster. It's not even overturning the Byrd rule. And by the way, if you vote to, if you overrule or disregard the parliamentarian, moderate senators who disagree with you could still vote against your decision, because it takes 60 votes to actually overturn the chair's decision. So you could give the moderate senators a way of saying, look, vote against our decision. If you disagree with it, you can stand up for a more strict interpretation of the Byrd rule, but you could be with us in final passage. It seems to me so little downside. I don't think most Americans even knew that there was a parliamentarian in the Senate who had this kind of power. What they care about is, are we going to deliver? And saying we didn't deliver because of a parliamentarian ruling, I'm not sure that's going to fly.
I don't know, Congressman. I think that there's millions of Americans that if on the one hand they could get an increase to minimum wage, but it would involve offending the parliamentarian, I think they would willingly forgo that raise to their wage. But anyway.
The irony is, I don't even think the parliamentarian would be offended. I doubt she wants to be making this decision. You know, her job is to give an advisory opinion. She didn't sign up to be making decisions about millions of people's fate. And partly, I feel for her. She shouldn't be in this position. She shouldn't be demonized. Just have the guts to make the call. That's the person. Yeah. The person who should be making the call is the chair.
So my final question for you, sort of looking ahead to where this might go, if it doesn't go the way that you seem to want it to. Historically, midterm elections are not good for the party in power. And we know that there's literally hundreds of bills being proposed around the country to limit voting, to try to ensure that the Republicans will do as well as they can manipulate themselves into doing. To what extent you can speak to it, but Joe, the president, the vice president, do they get what the midterms are going to be like if they don't deliver on these promises? Do they not, like, they seem to be scared of some things. Are they not scared of what those midterms might be like?
Well, I think they are understandably concerned first and foremost on COVID. And they are right to say that the biggest priority has to be getting the vaccinations out. It has to be getting COVID under control. The second biggest priority has to be immediate economic assistance to people. And all of that is right. But there's a third pillar to that, which is we need our voters mobilized. We need our activists mobilized. They all mobilized and went through risk to their own health to go vote. Some of those, I was talking to them on just on Monday, the fair wage campaign, where they were tipped workers making $2.13, and they were told, you're gonna get finally a dignity wage. So to get those folks, that they're not gonna go vote Republican, but are they gonna go out and mobilize and get folks out to the polls? That's the concern. And when we don't have that kind of mobilization, when we don't have that kind of turnout, we don't win. Certainly we don't win in the midterms. And so it's the morally right thing to do. I don't think it should be guided by politics, but politically we would be making a huge mistake if we don't speak to the aspirations of a Fed base.
I couldn't agree more. And as always, Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.